feeling neglected, and actually sounded quite snide just then. But really, it's hardly fair of Mum. How many daughters in their 30s talk to their mothers on the phone every single day? How many daughters join their mothers for fortnightly manicures, monthly facials, and cut and colours every 6 weeks? Her mother is spoiled, that's the problem. Of course, Sophie is also spoiled. They've spoiled each other. You should be thankful you've only got a small family, Claire was always telling Sophie. You've never had to endure emotional blackmail from your mother. Mothers specialise in it. I spend half my life feeling guilty. It turns out that Gretel can do emotional blackmail with the best of them. Sophie feels quite proud of her. She'll have to tell Claire that her family isn't quite so lovey-dovey after all. That fairy tale facade hides conflict, issues. They're dysfunctional. Next, they'll be on Jerry Springer, throwing chairs at each other. Sophie treats herself to 2 Turkish Delight chocolates from her emergency stash next to the bed. As the familiar sweetness fills her mouth, she looks at herself in the mirror and wriggles her shoulder so her glittery wings flap. She looks okay. She looks cute. The children will love it. Also, her cleavage is quite impressive. At least one of her suitors, Rick or Ian, Callum, is sure to be weak-kneed with lust when they see her. It's true that this may indicate questionable tendencies, but still, she's been celibate for so long, she'll take it any way she can get it. She lifts her pink satin skirts and hurries down the spiral staircase. She has to meet Aunt Rose to get her face painted. Grace pushes Jake in his stroller down the main street of the island, breathing in the smells of cold air and wood smoke, popcorn and mulled wine. Once, she and Callum were skiing in America when they walked into a bar and Grace sniffed and said, "I just got a whiff of anniversary night." After all these years of bigger and better innovations, it still seems to have exactly the same fragrance it had when she and Veronica and Thomas would run wild for the night, acting like little royals and telling the other children it was their island and they'd better be off it by midnight or the ghosts of Alice and Jack Munro would eat them for dinner. Of course, then came their teenage years, when they would just lope around, looking superior and sullen, and sneaking off for illicit cigarettes. One year, Veronica decided that the whole concept of the anniversary was disgusting and disrespectful. How could they celebrate the deaths, possibly the murders, of their great-grandparents? The three of them had worn black and held a private wake for Alice and Jack on the beach at Sultana Rocks. They'd held torches under their chins and chanted incantations that Veronica had written. Aunt Connie had discovered them and laughed, which had wounded their pride, and then she had apologized, which had confused them. It feels wrong having the anniversary night without Aunt Connie. But it seems like everything is going smoothly. Margie hasn't left anything to chance. The fairy lights are on and sparkling. The island staff, who, after all, know the drill pretty well after all these years, are standing to attention behind the food-laden trestle tables which line the street. The performers are limbering up and checking their equipment. The tarot card reader is sitting behind her table shuffling her cards. At the end of the street is a big stage, and Callum's jazz band are tuning up their instruments. This is the 3rd year they've played for the anniversary. They were a big hit the 1st year, and Callum was so touchingly chuffed when Aunt Connie told him the Snazzy Jazzies was the best band they'd ever had for the anniversary. There will be a jukebox afterwards, and Callum will be giving dance lessons. He thinks rock and roll, or swing, He's going to see what the crowd is like. She watches Callum's familiar body, made strange by distance. He's such a good man. Kind and funny and fundamentally good all the way through. Not like Grace, who has a secret, rancid core, who is capable of thinking terrible thoughts, who, if somebody bumps into her in the shopping centre, will sometimes horrify herself by screaming silent obscenities, "Don't fucking touch me!" It's probably only the constraints of society that curtail her capacity for unspeakable cruelty. She should never have been allowed to be a mother. She should have been sterilized. Early guests are starting to arrive, spilling off the extra ferries that will be running all night. Grace looks at the faces of the families walking by, flushed with excitement and probably too many clothes. They're all obediently dressed in parkas and beanies, as if they're in the snowy mountains, not Scribbly Gum Island. "Excuse me?" A beaming female face swims into focus. A woman has touched her on the arm, and Grace is disconcerted, as though someone on television waved at her. She feels so remote from the world, from normal people, she thought she was invisible. "Do you know where we go for the face painting?" asks the woman. "Actually, I'm one of the face painters," answers Grace. "We'll be setting up in about half an hour." "Fairy floss!" shrieks the little boy. Grace sees Sophie in her fairy outfit, surrounded by children, laughing as she swirls floaty fairy floss around a stick from her tub. Sophie is shimmery pink and pure. She is another good person. A dear little sunflower. A sweet little sugar cube. A sunny little honey. The perfect match for Callum. Sophie hands an impatient child a stick of fairy floss and sees Grace walk by, pushing the baby in his stroller. She's all in black. Black jeans, black jumper. Her hair is out, hanging straight down her back, and it looks very blonde. As she gets closer, Sophie sees the impatient child's father's eyes drawn to her, flicking up and down her body. He sees that Sophie has caught him looking and says, half apologetically, half leering, "Well, that's what I call a yummy mummy." Why is he talking to Sophie like she's a bloody mate in a pub? She gives her most charming smile and says, "And that's what I call a sleazy daddy." He chuckles uncertainly and drags his son away by the elbow. "Free fairy floss?" offers Sophie brightly to the man who appears to be next in line. He's not dressed as warmly as all the other guests. He's wearing jeans and a yellow surfy sort of t-shirt. He looks about 50, with a paunchy stomach, stubbled jaw, and an earring. "Oh, not exactly free, is it?" he says. "Not when you've paid $75 a ticket." Sophie notices that he is carrying some sort of elaborate vase shoved under one armpit. Has he stolen it from one of their houses? "Well, everything is included in your ticket price," says Sophie. "Would you like some?" "Can't stand the stuff. Rots your teeth." "Aren't you the charmer?" thinks Sophie, smiling beatifically. "I'm looking for someone called Veronica Gordon," he says. "I've got a business appointment with her." Oh, goodness. He's the kook. Everyone has been talking about this man who responded to Veronica's ad about Alice and Jack in the paper. They'll all be delighted to see how unsavory he looks, which will confirm their suspicions. Grandma Enigma has declared that she intends to give him a good piece of her mind. "But what if he really does have information about Alice and Jack?" Sophie had asked. "Well, I can assure you he doesn't," Enigma had said. "He's a con man. Oh, it makes my blood boil." "Veronica will be here somewhere," says Sophie, but I don't know where. Are you sure I can't offer you any fairy floss? If you see her, will you tell her I'm looking for her? Says the kook. He turns and glares down at a little girl who is sighing loudly and elaborately behind him. Well, you're taking too long, says the little girl, unperturbed. People are waiting for their fairy floss. Where are your manners? Asks the kook, suddenly looking just like a baffled grandparent, and he wanders back into the crowd, clutching his vase. Grace is already painting her 10th child with a blue and silver face inspired by Gublet McDoublet. She's painting the boys, while beside her Aunt Rose gives the girls pink and gold Melly the Music Box dancer faces. It had been Rose's idea to give the children Gublet and Melly faces this year, in honour of Grace's books. Grace had pretended to think it was a wonderful idea. No need to mention that Gublet hadn't been himself lately. Grace always paints the boys because it's hard work keeping them still. She keeps a firm hand clamped on their heads and whispers that they need to sit very still or else she's liable to accidentally poke out their eyeballs. The boys like this sort of talk and give her respectful, masculine looks. There you go. All done. Grace holds up a mirror in front of a grumpy 6-year-old. His eyes widen as he sees his own transformed face in the mirror. But I want to be a scary lion. Next, please, says Grace, ignoring the child's mother, who is smiling fondly under the mistaken impression that Grace finds her child as adorable as she does. Grace can see that Aunt Rose is already drooping. She's painting much slower than usual, even with the standard fast-track design. The face-painting queue is snaking all the way down the road. Dozens and dozens of squirmy, whiny, often quite remarkably snotty children. Why don't we ask Mummy to blow that nose? Shudders Grace as the next little boy takes the stool in front of her. At least Grandma Enigma doesn't seem to be having any trouble minding the baby. She is sitting right next to one of the gas heaters in a comfy chair with the baby on her lap, under a sign that says, Meet the Munro Baby, Scribbly Gums, Enigma, graciously signing autographs and allowing people to be photographed with her. When Grace had gone over to check on them, Grandma Enigma was using Jake as a handy prop for her performances, telling people that this was her great-grandson and isn't it amazing that she was a baby just like this little darling when her parents vanished into thin air 73 years ago today. Are you okay, Aunt Rose? Says Grace as her little boy gives a horrendously loud sniff. Shall I get one of the girls to bring you another cup of tea? I'm fine, darling, says Rose. My back hurts a bit. Next year, I think we should employ other people to do the face painting. And we'll just supervise. Sophie says that's called sauce out, or something like that, and it's very fashionable and fun. Are you okay, Grace? Happy? I'm happy. She is happy. She realizes. She has that euphoric feeling you get at the airport after you've checked in your luggage. Nothing can stop your journey. You've started sliding down the slippery dip. You're going away and leaving all your problems far, far behind. There's nothing more to do. Chapter 49. Every now and then there is a flurry of demand, but for the most part, being the Fairy Floss Fairy doesn't require much effort. Sophie smiles at the people walking by, waves her wand in what she hopes is an authentically magical manner, and enjoys the entertainment. The stalking stilt walkers, the leaping about jugglers, the garishly grinning clowns. She can see Rick, the gorgeous gardener, doing his fire-eating performance from where she stands, and it's all very primeval and arousing. He's wearing a sort of Aladdin's cave-style vest over a bare chest, and his muscly arms look impressive in the firelight as he throws back his head and lowers the flaming stick into his mouth. The watching crowd roars with approval, but Sophie wants to call out, "Oh, stop that! You'll burn yourself!" It's much more relaxing to watch Callum's band. They're very good. Three tall guys, one playing saxophone, who strongly reminds her of somebody, but she can't be bothered working out who, one playing drums, and Callum on double bass. The music is sexy and mellow, and Sophie has to keep dragging her eyes away from Callum. It's just that it's more appealing to watch a man play an instrument than shove fire down his throat. It's just that she has a terrible crush, which won't go away. What would have happened if she'd just kissed him in that steamy bathroom last night? Would he have reeled back in disgust? "Excuse me, why would I want to kiss a hobbit like you with my beautiful wife in another room?" "Yes, but honey, sweetheart, darling, your beautiful wife is going to leave you any day now. And I sort of love you." "Oh, stop it. You do not. You do not. You do not. Not even close." She swirls her fairy floss and feels a bit sick. Think about your potential new boyfriends, unencumbered by wives and children. She looks back to Rick the gardener, his teeth white in the firelight. He is, truth be told, the sexiest man she has ever dated. That kiss on the picnic. It was extraordinary. And of course, kissing Ian the solicitor in his plush, new car-smelling Lexus, breathing in his expensive aftershave, had been very enjoyable too. Both of them are much more eligible, and in fact better looking, than big, messy Callum. "Oh, but it's Callum," she wants to kiss. She wants to kiss him very, very, very badly. She needs to kiss him. It's a need, not a want. She is 39 years old, wearing a fairy costume and thinking about kissing boys. She has definitely regressed. It is imperative that she has proper grown-up sex in a bed with a sensible brand condom and a nice, friendly, middle-aged man very soon. She was thinking more mature thoughts when she was 20. "Sophie!" It's Veronica. Sophie feels her muscles flex involuntarily. "Hi." But Veronica looks different. Her hair seems fluffier, her face softer and rounder, less manic. She's with an attractive dark-haired girl wearing a cream-colored jumper. They're holding hands. They're holding hands? Holy moly! "Sophie, this is Audrey. Audrey, this is Sophie, who I told you about. Sophie, this is Audrey, my girlfriend, Audrey." Veronica looks triumphant and expectant, her cheeks flushed. "It's nice to meet you, Audrey," says Sophie. "Holy moly! My girlfriend, Audrey," repeats Veronica. Sophie waves her wand graciously. She is her mother's daughter. She can handle an unexpected change in sexual orientation no problem at all. "Can I offer you both some fairy floss?" "Fairy floss. Yes, please," says Audrey. "Did you hear what I said?" Veronica swings Audrey's hand. "Audrey is my girlfriend. My lover." "I think she gets it, Veronica," says Audrey. "I get it, Veronica." Sophie smiles at Audrey and hands her an extra large stick of floss. It turns out that I am gay, announces Veronica impressively. Yes, you are, sweetie. Audrey throws an arm around Veronica and vigorously pats her arm. Yes, you are. Veronica looks aggrieved. Well, you don't seem very surprised, Sophie. I was. Although, at the same time, I wasn't. It was like I knew it, but didn't know it, if you know what I mean. I blame my repressive middle-class upbringing, obviously. I'm really happy for you, says Sophie, honestly. In fact, this isn't actually all that unexpected now she thinks about it. She wonders why she never considered the possibility before. I'm not just experimenting, if that's what you're thinking, says Veronica. You're probably thinking I'm bisexual. Is that what you're thinking? That I'm bisexual? No. No, I'm not at all. Bisexuals are like agnostics, trying to have it both ways. My sexuality isn't in question. I have fully embraced my homosexuality. Sophie realizes that her reaction isn't up to scratch. She understands it's annoying when people don't gasp for long enough over an unexpected event in your life. You're still shaking your head. I can't believe this has happened to me. While they've already fully accepted it and moved on to something surprising in their own life. Gosh, your car was stolen. What a bummer. Did I tell you the doctor thinks I might have dislocated my shoulder from lifting that box? I couldn't believe it. So she shakes her head in wonder and says, well, this is quite a bombshell. I'm in shock. I'm dumbfounded. Veronica looks slightly mollified. Well, but why aren't you blushing? I was sure you'd blush. I told Audrey not to be surprised, and that your blush was a disorder, and it didn't mean you were prejudiced against the gay community. I mean, obviously, we have to deal with a lot of discrimination, just in everyday life. We're used to that. Comes with the territory. Veronica looks noble. I've joined the Glass Bay Gay Rights Association, obviously. Obviously, murmurs Audrey into her fairy floss. Gay rights have got a long way to go, a long way to go. I mean, it's ridiculous. We can't even legally get married in our own country. Steady on, girl. Audrey lifts a comical eyebrow. Oh. Veronica looks suddenly, endearingly embarrassed, even shy. Not that we're talking about marriage at this early stage of our relationship, obviously. I mean, you know, not yet. Why don't you get us a few glasses of that mulled wine I can smell in the air, suggests Audrey. Sophie could probably do with a drink. I don't know why she has to work when you're not doing anything. Because she's crazy, says Veronica, recovering. I stopped helping out with the anniversary night years ago. I don't actually approve of celebrating murder. I'll go check out the mulled wine. Last year it was much too sweet. Oh, Veronica, says Sophie, remembering, the kook is here, looking for you. The one who responded to your ad about Alice and Jack. He's walking around carrying some sort of vase, wearing a yellow T-shirt. Veronica doesn't look especially interested. I'm sure he'll find me. I might actually have to put the Munro mystery book on hold for a while. I've got a lot of other projects I'm more interested in. I'm very busy, you know. She walks briskly off, looking fierce and joyful. Sophie and Audrey watch her go and then look back at each other. I've never seen her so happy, says Sophie. You must be good for her. Audrey tears off a piece of fairy floss and rubs it thoughtfully between her fingers into a sticky pink ball. You do know she was in love with you. I beg your pardon? Says Sophie. And now the blush does come, engulfing her face. Because it makes perfect sense. That's why Veronica was always so possessive. If a male friend had behaved like that, Sophie would have guessed it immediately and been tender and careful with him. She feels guilty and silly and somehow horribly hetero, shallow and suburban, as if she should have known and her own parochial prejudices didn't let her see it, as if she'd subconsciously encouraged and at the same time repelled Veronica's affections. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to embarrass you," says Audrey. "I could just tell the way she talked about you so much, that she was a bit mixed up about you." "I think she's over you now, anyway. I sure hope she is." "Oh, I'm sure she is." Sophie knows her face is incandescent. She watches Audrey trying not to stare as the blush takes hold. It's a bad one. Blotches of burning color sting her neck like an attack of hives. "It's okay." Audrey seems to have developed a sudden intense interest in the band's performance. "I should never have said anything. I was just a bit jealous, I think. It's a failing of mine, and I really like Veronica. She's gorgeous, like a porcupine, spiky but cuddly. I just feel like maybe this time I finally got it right. Anyway, I can see why she likes you." "Thank you." Sophie's composure returns. She saves up spiky but cuddly for Callum and Grace. "I can see why she likes you, too." "Ha! Now you're blushing," crows Veronica as she returns holding three large glasses of mulled wine. "Is it a delayed reaction or what?" "It's okay, Audrey. You don't need to pretend to look away. Sophie isn't embarrassed by her blushing." Sophie accepts the glass of wine thankfully. Veronica thinks of my blushing as a sort of party trick. She takes a sip of her wine. "Oh, this is fantastic." Veronica sniffs. "Not bad. Too much lemon, not enough nutmeg. Anyway, come on, Audrey. I want you to meet my grandma Enigma. Don't be surprised if she drops dead on the spot when she hears. Oh, and wait till I tell Dad. Dad will have a cardiac arrest. He'll have a stroke." "You know, you don't have to tell everyone tonight." Audrey looks panicky. "There's no rush. You can wait for the right time." "No time like the present." Veronica is already marching off, arms pumping. "Bye, Sophie." "Oh, God." Audrey shrugs helplessly at Sophie and hands over her mug of wine. "Here, take this." They disappear into the crowd. It seems that Veronica won't be content with merely coming out of the closet. She's leaping out. The pain in Rose's back has got so bad it feels deliberate, malicious. It hurts her feelings, as though someone has just taken a plank of wood and violently slammed it against her lower back. She takes a deep breath. The line of little girls waiting for their Melly the Music Box dancer faces is finally starting to dwindle. Grace has finished all the boys and is helping her out with the girls. "I'm really too old to still be doing the children's face painting. I'm 88 years old. I should be in a rocking chair with a blanket over my knees and people bringing me cups of tea. Mum, don't you think I'm too old for this now?" Her mother had died a few weeks before Rose's 15th birthday. But ever since Connie died, Rose has found herself missing her mother with fresh, childish grief. "My back really hurts, Mum. It's called rheumatoid arthritis. My doctor tells me to think happy thoughts. I'm afraid I thought rather a rude word." "You died before you turned 40, so you missed out on all the fun of getting old. Oh, it's a lark, Mum." Rose can feel the back of her mother's cool hand against her forehead. My poor Rosie. She dips her paintbrush deep in pale pink and tries to smile at the little girl sitting quietly in front of her, chubby legs sticking out, hands resting obediently on her knees. Excuse me, excuse me. Rose looks up from her painting to see a young fellow of about Ron's age carrying some strange sort of urn and wearing a yellow short-sleeved T-shirt without a jacket. Rose is appalled. You must be freezing. We must find another jacket for you. The little girl looks up and solemnly informs the man, I'm wearing two pairs of socks to keep my toes extra toasty. Well, I don't feel the cold, says the man in that irritable, overly formal way of men who feel foolish talking to children. I've never felt the cold. Excuse me, I wanted to ask you if you know where I can find Veronica Gordon. I've been looking for her all night. People keep telling me I've just missed her. She seems to move very fast. Well, you have just missed her again, actually. And yes, she does move fast. Her grandfather used to call her Speedy Gonzales. Veronica had been by with a pretty Asian girl with long, shiny, dark hair. Veronica had told Rose she was feeling gay, and Rose said that was lovely, and she was feeling quite gay herself, even though she wasn't really because her back was hurting so much. But it was so nice to see Veronica in a good mood instead of her normal agitated state. Then the two girls had giggled a lot about something, and Veronica had given Rose a kiss on the cheek, which was also unusual for her, and had made Rose feel teary. Look, I had an arrangement to meet this Veronica. I've got important information for her. He pats the urn he is holding under his arm. Rose doesn't like his tone. Suddenly she knows who he is. The kook. What sort of information? She says carefully. Information relating to the disappearance of Alice and Jack Munro. She gives him a steely look. I'm Rose Doughty. My sister and I found the Munro baby. I'd be very interested to hear this information. Very interested indeed. I bet you would, says the kook. Because you two sure made bucket loads of money from that little find, didn't you? Quite an operation you've got going here. He looks around with contempt and distractedly rubs his arms, even though he supposedly doesn't feel a cold. You've done very well out of all of this, haven't you? Rose can feel her heart vibrating with an old familiar terror, an ancient shame. She presses a hand to her chest. Oh, for heaven's sake, this is such nonsense. She's not a teenager anymore. Suddenly, she is furious with Connie. It was all her idea. Her bloody idea. Rose wanted to tell everyone when Enigma was six, back in 1938. But no, oh no, it all had to be done Connie's way. It always had to be done Connie's way. And sometimes she was wrong. The kook says, anyway, it's this Veronica I've got an arrangement with, so I'll keep trying to hunt her down. He crouches down so that he's at eye level with Rose. He has surprisingly nice brown eyes. By the way, I know exactly what you two did. We found a baby, says Rose. She can hear herself sounding like a tremulous old woman. That's all we did. Yeah. Good one. The kook bounces back up on his feet and disappears into the crowd. Whoops-a-daisy! Cries the little girl with delight as Rose's elbow knocks her paint palette flying so that pink paint and silver glitter slosh all over the little girl's warmly clad legs. Ron isn't quite sure what to do with himself. What does he normally do on anniversary nights when Margie is around? He can't remember. Years ago, when the kids were young, he always did the sausage sizzle. The anniversary nights weren't quite this glitzy back then. It seems to him that it was more fun in the 70s. He and Laura's husband, Simon, used to cook up hundreds of sausages, stick them in bread rolls with a bit of tomato, lettuce, and Margie's chutney sauce. Went down a treat. They drank a lot of beer and mucked around. Margie was always in a flap, running back and forth like a headless chook trying to keep Connie happy, while Laura just lounged around smoking cigarettes, looking sultry. Ron used to tease Margie, and Simon would say to Laura, "Why don't you help your poor sister?" But Laura would just ignore him and tilt back her head and blow smoke rings. She didn't actually seem to like Simon that much. Ron remembers thinking, "I'm glad Margie doesn't ignore me like that." So it was strange the way Laura reacted to Simon running off with his dental nurse. She never seemed to get over it, and every year those bitter lines of disappointment on either side of her mouth were carved deeper and deeper. Ron had missed Simon when he left and secretly felt let down by him, as if the life that was good enough for Ron wasn't good enough for Simon. Everything was different then. With more blokes on the island, it was more balanced, more normal. He misses Margie and Laura's dad, too. Good old Nat, with his sweet, simple way of looking at things. And Jimmy, of course, who had a more complicated way of viewing the world, and sometimes said something that really made you think. Ron is the last man standing. Callum doesn't count. He's up there now on stage looking like a right twat, plucking away at the strings of some sort of giant guitar. Ron doesn't trust men who play instruments, except for the drums. The island hasn't exactly fallen apart without the men. As Ron walks aimlessly down the main street, watching the guests happily munching on gourmet pita-fucking-pockets or something or other, getting their tarot cards read, shelling out more money to have their photograph taken with the Munro baby, Enigma smiling at the camera as if she's royalty, it occurs to him that this is a pretty slick event. And it was his wife who organized the whole damn thing. A few weeks ago, Ron had been involved with a product launch coordinated by an event planner, a blonde in a suit who kept snapping open and shut her mobile phone, running pointy-tipped fingers through her hair and looking harried and important. That event had been on a much smaller scale with a lot fewer people, but it had seemed to cause a lot more problems. Yet Margie, who certainly does not have a university degree in event planning, who did a year's worth of secretarial college when she was 16, had organized this whole thing. Managed all the staff, organized stuff like sound equipment, without making a fuss at all. He would hear her chatting away on the phone to people, talking about their babies and their hay fever and their holidays, sounding like she wasn't doing a thing but passing the time of day, when in fact, she was running a business. And Ron feels a sudden, painful surge of pride. That event planner could learn a thing or two from his wife. Ron stops to watch the fire-eating performance. It's the guy who does the gardening on the island, bit of a blockhead. No doubt the women like him. He's well-built. Probably works out every day. Ron puts a hand to his stomach. A bit flabby. He sucks it in and squares his shoulders. Maybe he needs to go to the gym himself. He thinks about the sex this morning. It was great. It was bloody great. But who was that woman? She sure as hell didn't act like his wife. Not even the Margie of years ago, when they were at it all the time. Ron was always the one who set the pace when it came to sex, but this morning? Thinking about it, Ron feels aroused and simultaneously panicked. What does it mean? What the fuck has she been doing? Her body didn't feel the same either. It felt firmer, stronger. She'd lost more weight than he'd realized. She looked good. She looked bloody good. He didn't really like it. And tonight, when she was getting ready to go to this Weight Watchers party, she'd been excited, nervous, breathless, as if she were going on a date. She had her hair all pulled back to show off her new skinny cheekbones, and she was wearing her diamond earrings and the perfume he'd got her duty-free on his last trip to Singapore. He'd asked again if he could go along and keep her company, but she'd insisted that partners weren't invited and laughed sort of kindly at him. And then, as she was leaving, he thought he'd heard her phone beeping again with another text message. If some other man had been touching his wife's body, he would... He would... Dad? You look like you're having a panic attack. It's Veronica, sparky and glittery and dancing around him like a boxer. Veronica? Suddenly, he's feverish for information. He grabs her arm. Do you send text messages to your mother? Did you text her this morning? Veronica rolls her eyes. No, Dad. I guess I didn't, seeing as I don't have a mobile phone. Seeing as I don't believe in mobile phones. Seeing as I know for a fact that they cause deadly brain tumors. I've read all the research. It's just like smoking and the tobacco companies. There is a massive cover-up going on. I've told you all this before. You don't listen. Anyway, Dad, I've got something to tell you. I want you to meet my friend, Audrey. My girlfriend, Audrey. Ron drops Veronica's arm and stares at her, but right through her. Margie told him a lie. But Margie is incapable of lying. She tried to organize a surprise party for him once, and he'd been onto it within seconds. And on her 40th birthday, when she'd learned the truth about Alice and Jack, she had been distraught. How am I going to live a lie? She'd asked him, after she told him the true story, which she was allowed to do, apparently, because they'd been married for 20 years. So it was okay, according to the law of Connie. After he'd signed a confidentiality agreement, of course. If Margie had lied, it could only mean one thing. She's having an affair. His wife is having an affair at a Weight Watchers party right now. But wait a sec. There probably is no party. That's what people do when they're having affairs. They make stuff up. She's probably in a hotel. In a jacuzzi. Drinking champagne with some hairy-chested dickhead, probably in real estate. And champagne goes straight to her head. And she'd be impressed if he told her it was Moe, when it was probably Great Fucking Western. And she could be doing anything. She could be... Well, she could be... Ron shudders with violent revulsion. Dad? Veronica swims back into view. I know it's a shock, she says kindly. She knows about the affair. She feels sorry for her humiliated father. Ron clutches again at her arm. So you know everything? She's told you all about it? Okay, fine. I can deal with that. Just tell me where she is. Veronica's face scrunches up with irritated confusion. Tell you where who is? Your mother, of course. I don't know where Mum is, Dad. She told me she had to go to some function with her Weight Watchers friend. Oh, God, this is just so typical. I'm trying to tell you something important. I'm trying to introduce you to my girlfriend, Audrey. Audrey sticks out her hand and Ron shakes it. Nice to meet you, Audrey. He says automatically, I'm sorry, I have to call my wife right now. There's a family crisis. He pulls out his mobile phone and begins to dial. I'm sorry, he says again distractedly to Veronica, who has her hands on her hips, her mouth slightly open, and that familiar expression of disgusted disappointment. Oh, for Pete's sake! Veronica grabs her friend's hand and drags her off into the crowd. Margie's phone begins to ring, and Ron presses his mobile to his ear with a clenched, sweaty fist. Rick has finished his fire-eating performance and has come over to see Sophie. His hair is sweatily tousled, his chest very wide. Sophie wonders if Veronica has really thought this lesbian thing through. He says, "You look beautiful." "Well, you look extremely sexy," says Sophie. She has now had two glasses of deliciously good mulled wine and is feeling buoyant and slightly in love with everybody. "Do you have a horrible taste in your mouth from all that fire eating? Do you want some fairy floss?"
"No, thanks. I've been wanting to talk to you. I came around yesterday, but you weren't there."
Sophie gives him a flirtatious look through her eyelashes and is conscious of her cleavage. Her heart lifts. She doesn't know why she's even been worrying about this. Rick is perfect for her. Her body knows it. Her heart knows it. Her mind knows it. He is the one. She is definitely, absolutely going to sleep with him tonight, and it's going to be damned good. It will be the beginning of a whirlwind romance with sex, 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 and talking till dawn and walks on the beach in chunky jumpers and frolicking in parks, throwing frisbees, and she'll be pregnant just in time for her 40th birthday. "I'm here now," she smiles and gives her wand a provocative flick. "How can I help you? Need me to perform a spell on you?"
It's a bit awkward. I just thought I should tell you that I've got back with my ex-girlfriend."
"Oh, for heaven's sake!" Sophie lets her wand drop. She's going to remember that wand-flicking, eyelash-batting performance and cringe for the rest of her life.
"Oh, I see," she says. She pauses. "I suppose I could turn her into a frog."
He grins ruefully. "I should have told you when we went out that I'd only recently come out of a relationship, but I didn't want you to think I was one of those guys with all this baggage, and I really thought we were over for good. But then she sent me an email the other night, and we just started being honest with each other about our feelings. Please excuse me while I vomit into my fairy floss."
"I'm sorry," continues Rick. "I had a great time with you the other day. It's just that I was with her for years, and I can't turn my back on that."
Sophie gives him a radiant smile. "Of course you can't. I understand. Absolutely. I hope things work out for you."
"Yeah, well, I really want to make a go of it. Tie the knot. You know, all that boring stuff. Settle down, be a dad. I'm ready for all that."
He's ready to be a dad. It's hurting Sophie's face to smile.
"That's great, Rick. Really. Hey, do you think you could get me another one of those mulled wines?"
Just when he thinks it's going to voicemail, she answers the phone. "Hello?" Except it's not Margie. It's a man's voice. "It's him." He has a deep, salesy, "I've got money and a big dick" voice. He is definitely in real estate. He probably wears a gold bracelet and carries a man bag. Ron feels like his head is about to explode. Ron says, with considerable difficulty, "Who is this?" The bloke answers, "This is Ron."
"Who's this?"
"Ron?"
"This is Ron!" roars Ron. The bloke chuckles.
"Good name, mate."
Ron speaks through grimly gritted teeth. "Do you want to explain why you're answering my wife's phone?"
"Margie's just getting dressed. Do you want me to get her?"
Now his head does explode.
"Are you for fucking real?" Oh, darling, you are not, says Enigma. Stop being silly.
Enigma is feeling snappy. Nobody has brought her anything to eat, except for that sandwich, which was hours ago. Margie really did go out tonight, which Enigma didn't truly believe was going to happen right until the last minute. The baby is starting to get all tetchy and squirmy, and where is his mother, for heaven's sake? There has been no sign of Grace for ages. And now here is Veronica announcing quite loudly that she is one of those homosexuals. Enigma has no problems with those homosexuals in general. They seem like decent, kind people, and they dress beautifully. She just doesn't like it when they flaunt their funny ways in public, such as that awful Mardi Gras. It's not necessary. People can do what they like in the privacy of their own homes. However, it is quite ridiculous to think that her granddaughter is one of them. Besides which, she thought it was only the men who were the homosexuals. Why does Veronica have to be such a tomboy? Enigma smiles politely at the Japanese girl who seems to have given Veronica these ridiculous ideas and does her best to set her straight. It's just that we don't do that sort of thing in our family, dear. Don't be so rude, Grandma, cries Veronica. Well, we don't, Veronica. Enigma is incensed. She has just made a real effort to be polite to this Japanese girl, especially when you consider that one of Enigma's loveliest boyfriends during the war was a prisoner of war in a Japanese concentration camp and came back all skinny and miserable and not at all lively anymore. The Japanese girl says, "It's okay, Veronica. Let's talk about this another time." She says to Enigma, "Is that your great-grandson you've got there?" "Yes, this is little Jake." Enigma immediately holds out the baby, hopefully. "Would you like a hold of him, dear? My arms are aching." "Oh, Grandma, Audrey isn't here to help you babysit," says Veronica. But the girl takes Jake, which is a relief for Enigma's poor arms. "So you're from Japan, Audrey?" asks Enigma socially. Veronica huffs and puffs while Audrey says, "My parents are Malaysian, actually, but I was born here." "Oh, well, Malaysia." Enigma tries to think of something nice to say about Malaysia. Didn't Laura used to make quite a nice beef dish from Malaysia? But just then, a very unattractive, underdressed man comes charging out of the crowd and grabs Veronica's elbow. "Are you Veronica Gordon? I've been looking for you all night. I've got information about the Munro baby." "Uh-huh. It's the kook." Enigma is delighted to have the opportunity to give this silly fellow a piece of her mind. "I am the Munro baby, sitting right here in front of you," she says firmly. "I'm afraid you are a con man, young man. And goodness me, you're not dressed nearly warmly enough." Sophie looks at her watch. They say that the time it takes to recover from a relationship is half its length. And she dated Rick, the gorgeous gardener, for approximately 3 hours, so by her calculations, she has approximately 20 more minutes of grieving left to do. She takes another mouthful of her mulled wine. It really is the best mulled wine she has ever had in her entire life. It gives her a warm, spicy glow right at the center of her chest, which is now spreading to her knees. She tries to identify the red wine they've used. Definitely a Shiraz. She probes tentatively at her heart. Yep, she's over him, ahead of time. The man was entirely inappropriate. They were completely incompatible. He didn't especially like eating out. He got up at 6 a.m. and did yoga each morning. How irritating! He was a vegetarian. She couldn't stand vegetarians. Clearly, He wasn't the young man mentioned in Aunt Connie's letter. He was a red herring. A vegetarian red herring. Now, where is that Ian the sweet solicitor? He's meant to be dropping by tonight. Sophie has always had a very clear, very definite preference for Ian. Could it be that Aunt Connie had a premonition that Grace was going to leave Callum and she actually meant... Well, it wasn't beyond the realms of possibility, was it? Oh, yes, Sophie. Connie was really hoping that Grace and Callum's marriage would break up just after they'd had a new baby. I'm sure she would have approved of that. Definitely. Good one, you 39-year-old loser. Sophie. Hi. It's Thomas and Deborah and baby Lily in a stroller. A stern message from the cosmos about thinking of breaking up happy families. When you could have been the mummy in this one, and you let the chance go because you thought you could do so much better. The three of them are wearing matching raspberry-coloured jumpers. Lily is an adorable munchkin with creamy skin and huge chocolatey eyes. Looking at her, Sophie experiences one of those unexpectedly painful bursts of longing and regret that makes her dig her nails into the palms of her hands. Stuffed it up, buttercup. Well, hello there, let me get you all some fairy floss, says Sophie. Oh no, Lily is much too young for fairy floss. Deborah leaps in front of Lily's stroller with arms outspread to save her child's life. Gosh! Just in the nick of time, says Sophie. I was about to ram it down her throat. Thomas, Deborah, and Lily all stare blankly at her. And Sophie laughs merrily to try and make it sound like that was a clever witticism rather than the bitter barb of a childless ex-girlfriend. How are you, Sophie? Asks Thomas stiffly. All settled into the house? Yes, I am. I'm very happy. She overdoes the charm, trying to make up for her earlier remark. I'm so grateful to Aunt Connie. I'm very blessed. Blessed? Where did she unearth such a word? She sounds like a middle-aged spinster in a cardigan and pearls. Well, she is, of course, a middle-aged spinster in a fairy costume. Good. Thomas rubs his hands together like a country minister. Great. Sophie has a sudden memory of sitting on a kitchen bench with her legs wrapped around Thomas's waist and watching his pumping buttocks reflected in the kitchen window. They had both been proud of themselves for having sex in the kitchen because it was proof of a proper movie-style passion, although they never did it again. Afterwards, Thomas had made her fantastic scrambled eggs with Tabasco sauce, and she had really thought she loved him. It is so strange that you can end up having such polite, awkward conversations with somebody with whom you once shared such intimate moments. She feels this is so interesting that it really should be commented upon, and nearly does, before realizing it is perhaps not appropriate, and perhaps she is a little tipsy. A drunken fairy floss fairy is probably not good for Scribbly Gum Island's corporate identity. She notices that Deborah is also holding a glass of mulled wine. Deborah, she cries rapturously, isn't this wine extraordinarily good. Deborah grudgingly smacks her lips. It is quite flavoursome. Thomas frowns, not enough nutmeg, too much lemon. That's exactly what Veronica said. Sophie feels suddenly very fond of them both and turns to Deborah. Don't you just love the way this family talks about food? They get these irritable, earnest expressions, like scientists. Deborah opens and shuts her mouth. She breathes in deeply through her nostrils as if she's about to sneeze. Then she says, I'm the sort of person who says exactly what she thinks, and I think I should say this.
Deb!
Thomas's face contorts, and his arm shoots out and grabs her elbow as if to save her from falling off a cliff. Some wine spills onto Deborah's hand and she glares at him. Now look what you made me do.
We'll get you some more, says Sophie helpfully. Thomas, why don't you get us both some more?
Because I'm starting to suspect they've overdone it on the brandy, says Thomas.
Rubbish, says Deborah. Oh, definitely not, says Sophie.
Oh, Jesus, says Thomas.
Deborah drains the rest of her glass, hands it to Thomas, licks her lips and says to Sophie,
He's still in love with you.
Did you know that?
You're the love of his life.
Where are you? Asks Ron. Tell me where you are right now.
He has become icy calm. He is going to find this man and kill him with a single efficient blow to the head.
No need to get your knickers in a knot, Ron. We're here at the Hilton.
Why? Do you want to come and watch? It's no problem.
Come and watch?
Ron slams his expensive mobile phone to the ground and grinds it beneath his heel, much to the pleasure of a group of boys who assume he's a street performer beginning some sort of violent skit.
Oh, Deborah, I'm not. I know that I'm not, says Sophie.
She's not, says Thomas. I swear to you, she's not.
Deborah wails.
Then why did you say it? Last night. Don't pretend you don't know what I'm talking about.
Sophie thinks, oh my goodness, he didn't. Although it's hard not to feel flattered. Thomas looks like a man who has been kicked in the kidneys.
This is excruciatingly embarrassing.
I don't care if it's embarrassing. You still love her. You said her name when we were making love. That's what's known as a Freudian slip. And Freudian slips mean that's what you really think deep down in your superego or something.
Deborah, says Sophie earnestly, lovingly. Poor Deborah. Poor, sweet travel agent Deborah. The thing is, Thomas and I weren't at all compatible. We had a terrible sex life. Terrible!
Oh, God, you're both drunk, says Thomas.
And you've got such a beautiful baby girl, cries Sophie, gesturing lavishly at Lily.
Don't you bring Lily into it, says Deborah fiercely.
Oh, well, I just meant I know exactly what you meant.
Sophie isn't sure that she likes Deborah's tone. She was just trying to be nice. She tries to think of something devastatingly clever to say about Deborah's grasp of Freudian theories, but she can't quite remember anything about Freudian theories herself, even though she got a high distinction on an essay on the subject at uni. But then they're interrupted.
Sophie, I've been looking everywhere for you.
It's Ian, the sweet solicitor. And he's perfect. He's dressed in a casual, stylish but not too stylish suede jacket and black jeans. He looks tall and funny and gently intellectual. Sophie cannot think what her problem has been. This is the man she will sleep with tonight. This is the man who she will have a mature relationship with over the next few months, including weekend getaways, possibly a trip to Europe, champagne brunches with friends, dinners with parents, lots of sophisticated sex in his luxury.